I would like to speak this morning on Psalm 118. This is a magnificent psalm of praise. And it appears that the psalm was written to be sung on some great national occasion, perhaps a victory in battle. That certainly seems to be the occasion, that there has been some great Israelite victory, and the king is now leading the nation in this psalm of thanksgiving and praise to God. You're well aware, I'm sure, that many of the psalms were written so as to be sung by different people participating at different stages through the psalm. Maybe a soloist here, maybe a choir there. Sometimes you have people singing a response, the soloist singing and then a choir responding. All sorts of things happen in these psalms. And on this occasion, the setting caters for the participation of all sorts of people as the whole nation expresses its thanks to God for the great victory that has been won. Now let me just see if I can give you the picture of what's happening. Supposing that where I'm standing here is the altar, that is the altar out in the open courtyard of the temple. Behind me is the sanctuary, the actual building that is the holy place and the most holy place. Here is the altar, and standing beside the altar we have a group of priests on one side, and over there on the other side, let us say, we have a group of singers, some of the temple singers. Up there, at the entrance to this building, let us say, in our imagined layout, up there at the entrance is the gate of the temple, that is the gate that leads from outside into this open enclosure. And there are guards at the gate, of course. And inside this enclosure, we have a lot of just the ordinary people. They're lined up on both sides of an aisle, all the ordinary people standing there. And outside is the king. Now, the king is coming to offer a sacrifice. And so you have this royal procession coming from outside, approaching the gates where the gatekeepers stand. And then he will progress down the aisle with the people of the nation on either side. We have the altar here. We have the priests on one side, we have the temple singers on the other. We probably have a soloist or two in different places, and then behind me is the sanctuary itself, the actual building. First of all, we have the call to worship, which somebody would sing by saying, or singing, "O give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever." Then the soloist invites all the different groups to participate in this great act of praise to God. The soloist would sing, "Let Israel say," and then the singers would respond, "His steadfast love endures forever." The soloist again, "Let the house of Aaron say," and then the priests would respond, "His steadfast love endures forever." And then the soloist in verse 4, "Let those who fear the Lord say," and then the common people would respond, "His steadfast love endures forever." And then the king, with stentorian voice outside the main gate there, sings the next three verses, 5, 6 and 7. And he says, "Out of my distress I called on the Lord, and the Lord answered me and set me free." The king now is recounting how God answered his prayers. "With the Lord on my side I do not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is on my side to help me. I shall look in triumph on those who hate me." There he was, I says, in distress, out in the battlefield, all my enemies, those who hate me. And yet I called on the Lord, and he answered me, and he set me free. What can man do to me now? And so in this great spirit of thankfulness and confidence, he comes to God, recounting how God answered his prayers, and now he's coming to offer his praise. And when he recounts his experience in verses 5 to 7, we find that in verses 8 and 9 the singers respond by saying, "Yes, it is better to take refuge in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to put confidence in princes." And there you can see a good example of the Hebrew poetry style, where one line is repeated, and in this case just with one word changed. What they're saying is, yes, you can trust in God. Trust in God and you will have victory. So the king has sung and the choir has responded. Now the king sings his second section in verses 10 to 14. And now he develops the the setting from what he had said previously. He describes his apparently hopeless position. There he was on the battlefield, enemies all round, no way out. It looks as if he was doomed, defeat staring him in the face, and somehow God answered his prayers and saved him. All nations surrounded me, verse 10, which isn't a bad example there to show you that you're not always to take the Bible literally. This is poetry, and when we read poetry, we've got to enter into the spirit of poetry. We realize that the Bible has figures of speech in it. When he says, all nations surrounded me, I don't think that the people from New Zealand were there, or people from Saudi Arabia, or from Argentina, or Eskimos and other people. What he is saying there, that all these people round about me, it might have only been just a few local tribes, for all we know. But anyway, as far as he was concerned, the whole world was against him. You've heard that expression before. All nations surrounded me, but in the name of the Lord, I cut them off. They surrounded me. They surrounded me on every side. But in the name of the Lord, I cut them off. They surrounded me like bees. They blazed like a fire of thorns. And in the name of the Lord, I cut them off. I was pushed hard so that I was falling. But the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. And so the king expresses the great deliverance which God brought when there he was, every escape route cut off, no hope whatever of deliverance, surrounded him like bees. And yet he says, somehow, in that hopeless position, God came in and saved him. And in the name of the Lord, he cut them off. And so God has become his salvation, and God is his strength and his song. And when he sings that, once again the singers respond and they say, yes, hark, glad songs of victory in the tents of the righteousness. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly. The right hand of the Lord is exalted. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly. So the king sings and the singers respond. The king sings again and the singers respond. And notice the progress. In the first section that the king sang, he recounted how God had answered his prayers. And the singers said, yes, God is worthy of man's trust. In the next section, the king recounted the apparently hopeless position he was in. And the singers respond, yes, God is all-powerful. And now the king comes to his third section in verses 17 to 19, and he says, I shall not die, I shall live and recount the deeds of the Lord. And that's what we're supposed to do. There's no doubt that when a person tells something of what God has done for him, that is what carries the weight. You meet somebody who knows nothing about God, and somehow you can share with that person what God means to you, what God has done for you. And that is the thing that has the ring of truth about it, the ring of reality. And the king has experienced this, and now he's going to go and tell other people about it. And if we've experienced something of it, then we also should recount the deeds of the Lord. Verse 18, the Lord chastened me sorely, but he has not given me over to death. He was chastened all right. It looked as if his throne was about to be toppled, Israel about to be defeated. Chastened sorely, but the Lord has not given me over to death. A great comfort to Christians. A great comfort to God's people of any age. Sometimes God's chastening is indeed hard to take. But it's for our good, and nobody ever enjoys punishment. But afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. God didn't give him over to death. It's never more than we can bear. And so he now comes, and he wants to bring his offering of thanksgiving to God for this marvelous victory. So he sings in verse 19, open to me the gates of righteousness, that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. He's standing outside the gates, you see. And now he wants to come through the gates and proceed up the aisle to the altar to offer his thanks to the Lord. He sings verse 19, of course, to the gatekeepers. And if you've read Chronicles, you'll find that the gatekeepers, again, were among the ceremonial singers in Israel. So in verse 20, the gatekeepers respond with their little piece in this musical presentation. And they say in verse 20, this is the gate of the Lord. You just can't come barging in here at any time just because you want to. This is the gate of the Lord. Only the righteous enter through it. Not anybody can just come into God's temple. It's not as if you're going to the shop or going into your living room. It's the gate of the Lord. Only the righteous can come in here, say the gatekeepers. That's what we're here for. We're here to protect these gates, to make sure that God's temple has the respect that's due to it. And then the king responds to the gatekeepers in verse 21. And he responds by praising God. He lifts his eyes to heaven and he says, I thank thee that thou hast answered me and thou hast become my salvation. God is my salvation, he says. He said it previously in verse 14. He says it again now. I come here, he says, realizing that I am unworthy. I was like a conquered person on the battlefield. I was brought low. I was chastened sorely. I've got nothing to skite about. It was only in God's goodness that I was saved, he says. God has become my salvation, and I come here not because of anything I am, but I come here because of what God is. It's really an Old Testament parallel to what we get in the New Testament. That we come before God not because of what we are, but because of what Christ is. He is our salvation, and it's in his name that we enter God's presence. It's because of what he has done that we have the right of access to God. And so the king says it's because of what God has done that I claim this right of access. He is my salvation. It's a marvelous expression of praise and thanks to God. And with that, we imagine then that the gatekeepers open the gate and the king enters. And as he enters, the people or the singers, somebody anyway, sings this very well-known song, verses 22 to 25. It's one of the most well-known pieces of the Bible and it's quoted frequently in the New Testament. You get various similar passages elsewhere in the Old Testament. They sing, the stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. There was the king looking like a useless building stone, lying on the ground, useless, good for nothing. And yet somehow God took that and made it the head of the corner. There was the king surrounded on every side, all escape cut off, like a useless builder's brick. And yet somehow, inexplicably, he got victory. Somehow the useless builder's stone was taken and made into a building. And who did it? Verse 23, the Lord. This is the Lord's doing, and it's marvelous in our eyes. God did that. God gave the king the victory. He has taken that king from this apparently hopeless position, and he's given him this victory. So this is the day that the Lord has made, verse 24. This day of victory, this day of celebration, when we can celebrate that great conquest of the kings, this is the day which the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Save us, we beseech thee, O Lord. O Lord, we beseech thee, give us success. You get the picture there? One victory increases their confidence to ask God for another victory. We have been saved. We rejoice in it today. In the future, likewise, O God, save us. Nothing is going to increase our confidence in God more than seeing God's answers to prayer, than seeing God work, and seeing God's deliverance. And the more we see that, the more it strengthens us. And the bolder we become, the more confident we become as we move on in fellowship with God, asking his help, claiming his presence and his power. Well, as they've been singing that song, the king has been progressing up the aisle. And now he approaches the altar, whereupon in verses 26 and 27, the priests get in on the act and they sing their section. And they sing, blessed is he who enters in the name of the Lord. The king has entered through the gate in the name of the Lord, as we saw in verse 20. He didn't come in his own name. He didn't come because he had gained the victory. He came because God was his salvation. He entered in the name of the Lord. And now the priests welcome him to the altar. Blessed is he who enters in the name of the Lord. We bless you from the house of the Lord. You see, they're standing in front of the house. They're standing there beside the altar with the house behind them. Verse 27, I don't think there are any two translations of the Bible which translate verse 27 the same. I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version, and it certainly, to me, appears to give the best sense. And when you compare it with the New Testament, that supports the RSV translation. The picture seems to be this, that all these people who were standing up, all the people of Israel standing up on both sides of this aisle as the king has progressed towards the altar, these people were all holding palm leaves in their hands, and they were waving these palm leaves backwards and forwards, welcoming the king in this triumphal procession. And as they waved those palm leaves and sang this song as the king walked down from the gate towards the altar, as they waved their palm leaves and sang the songs, it appeared as if the whole community was bound together by this waving mass of green. That, I think, is the meaning of verse 27. The Lord is God, he has given light, bind the festal procession with branches up to the horns of the altar. All the way from the gate, right up to the horns of the altar. The festal procession, the whole lot is bound together by these waving palm leaves, these waving branches. And as I say, it ties in with the New Testament because this is the section that is quoted when Jesus Christ entered Jerusalem. Again, blessed is he who enters in the name of the Lord. He came in lowly and meek and riding upon an ass. And there was the waving of the palm leaves once again as the people sang, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So that seems to be the picture. Verse 28, now the king has arrived at the altar. And now he's going to make his sacrifice. He says, Thou art my God, and I will give thanks to thee. He has an offering of thanksgiving. An animal maybe, whatever the offering happens to be. He has this animal with him, and this is his thanksgiving offering to God, and he is at the altar. The animal is now to be sacrificed upon the altar, and that is the expression of thanks to God from the king on behalf of the nation for this great victory which they have won. So, Thou art my God, I will give thanks to thee. Thou art my God, and I will extol thee. And that's just about the end. It's a great pity, isn't it, that the psalm ends just there. One would like the psalm to go on and give us the rest of the procedure. But even as we see this much, as we've reached this climax in the psalm, surely it just gives us this greater appreciation of God and of who he is and of what he has done, of the great mercy and love, of his inexplicable power, of the way he works in delivering people, and the great experience that it gives people of this God who is theirs, the God of their salvation, in whose name they worship, whom they come to praise and give thanksgiving to, and whose great deeds they extol. And as we've read this psalm together this morning, I'm sure that we can enter into the spirit of these people who were gathered on that great occasion at the temple in Jerusalem. And perhaps the last verse was a combination of all of them, the soloists, the singers, the priests, the king, the people, the gatekeepers, all of them joined together. And we with them in this final great note of praise, oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever.